Once in a while, I caught Henry's muffled protest, a sound suggestive of flinching and lots of blood gushing out. Just the thought of his suffering made me hyperventilate. I finally got so lightheaded I had to step outside, where I sat on the mini porch with my head between my knees. Henry eventually emerged, looking stricken and relieved, feeling at his numbed lip to see if he was drooling on himself. To distract him on the ride home, I filled him in on the cardboard box, the circumstances under which it originated, Mickey's paranoia, and the John Russell alias, and my own B&E adventure at Ted Rich's place. He liked the part about the dog, having urged me repeatedly to get one of my own. We had the usual brief argument about me and household pets. Then he said, "So, tell me about your ex. You said he was a cop, but what's the rest of it?" "Don't ask." "What do you think it means, his being delinquent with his storage fees?" "How do I know? I haven't talked to him in years," I said irritably. "Don't be like that, Kinsey. I hate it when you're stingy with information. I want the story on him." "It's too complicated to get into. Maybe I'll tell you later when I've figured it out." "Are you going to follow up?" "No." "Maybe he got lazy about paying his bills," he said, trying to draw me in. "Maybe. I doubt it. He was always good about that stuff." "People change," he shrugged. "No, they don't. Not in my experience." "Nor in mine, now you mention it." The two of us were silent for a block, and then Henry spoke up. "Suppose he's in trouble?" "Serves him right if he is." "You wouldn't help?" "What for?" "Well, it wouldn't hurt to check." "I'm not going to do that." "Why not? All it'd take is a couple of calls. What's it going to cost?" "How do you know what it'd cost? You don't even know the man." "I'm just saying you're not busy, at least as far as I've heard." "Did I ask for advice?" "I thought you did," he said. "I'm nearly certain you were fishing for encouragement." "I was not." "I see." "Well, I wasn't. I have no interest in the man." "Sorry, my mistake." "You're the only person in my life who gets away with this shit." When I got back to my desk, the first thing my eye fell on was my address book lying open to the M's. I flipped the book shut and shoved it in a drawer, which I closed with a bang. I sat down in my swivel chair and gave the carton a shove with my foot. I was tempted to chuck the damn thing, salvage the personal papers, and dump the rest in the trash. However, having paid the $20, I couldn't bring myself to do it. It wasn't so much that I was cheap, though that was certainly a factor. The truth is, I was curious. I reasoned that just because I looked through the box didn't make me responsible for anything else. It certainly wouldn't obligate me to try to locate my ex. Sorting through the items would in no way compel me to take action on his behalf. If Mickey'd fallen on hard times, if he was in a jam of some kind, then so be it. C'est la vie, and so what? It had nothing to do with me. I pulled the wastebasket closer to the box, pushed the flaps back, and peered in. In the time I'd been gone, the elves and fairies still hadn't managed to tidy up the mess. I started tossing out loose toiletries. A flattened tube of toothpaste and a shampoo bottle with a thin layer of sludge pooled along its length. Something had leaked out and oozed down through the box, welding articles together like an insidious glue. I threw out a hodgepodge of over-the-counter medications, an ancient diaphragm, a safety razor, and a toothbrush with bristles splayed out in all directions. It looked like I'd used it to clean the bathroom grout. From under the toiletries, I excavated the bundle of junk mail. When I picked up the stack, the rubber band disintegrated, and I plunked the bulk of it in the wastebasket. A few stray envelopes surfaced, and I pulled those from among the discarded magazines and dog-eared catalogs. Bullshit from the look of it. A bank statement for an account I'd closed many years before, a department store circular, and a notice from Publishers Clearinghouse telling me I'd been shortlisted for $1 million. The third envelope I picked up was a credit card bill that I sincerely hoped I'd paid. What a disgrace that would be, a blot on my credit rating. Maybe that's why American Express wasn't sending me any pre-approved cards these days. And here I'd been feeling so superior. Mickey's payments might be delinquent, but not mine, she said. I turned the bill over to open it. Stuck to the back was another envelope, this one a letter that had apparently arrived in the same post. I pulled the second envelope free, tearing the paper in the process. The envelope itself bore no return address, and I didn't recognize the writing. The script was tight and angular, letters slanting heavily to the left, as if on the verge of collapsing. The postmark, Santa Teresa, April 2nd, 1972. I'd left Mickey the day before. April Fool's Day, as it turned out. I removed the single sheet of lined paper, which was covered with the same inky cursive, as flattened as bent grass. Kinsey, Mickey made me promise not to do this, but I think you should know. He was with me that night. Sure, he pushed the guy, but it was no big deal. I know because I saw it, and so did a lot of other people who were on his side. Benny was fine when he took off. Him and Mickey couldn't have connect after, because we went back to my place and he was there till midnight. I told him I'd testify, but he says no because of Eric and his situation. He's completely innocent and desperately needs your help. What difference does it make where he was as long as he didn't do it? If you love him, you should take his part instead of being such a bitch. Being a cop is his whole life. Please don't take that away from him. Otherwise, I hope you find a way to live with yourself because you're ruining everything for him. D. I read the note twice, my mind blank except for a clinical and bemused response to all the misspellings and run-on sentences. I'm a snob about grammar, and I have trouble taking anyone seriously who gets their, T-H-E-R-E, possessives, confused with their, T-H-E-R-E, demonstratives. I didn't ruin Mickey's life. It hadn't been up to me to save him from anything. He'd asked me to lie for him, and I'd flatly refused. Failing that, he'd probably concocted this cover story with Dee, whoever she was. From the sound of it, she knew me, but I couldn't for the life of me remember who she was. Dee. That could be D, D-E-E, D-D, Donna, Dawn, Diane, Doreen. Oh, shit. Of course. I knew exactly who this was. There was a bartender named Dixie who worked in a place out in Colgate where Mickey and some of his cop buddies hung out after work. It wasn't uncommon for the guys to band together to do their after-hours drinking. In the early 70s, there were frequent watch parties at the end of a shift, revelries that sometimes went on until the wee hours of the morning. Both public and private drunkenness are considered violations of police discipline, along with extramarital affairs, failure to pay debts, and other scurrilous behaviors. Such violations are punishable by the department because a police officer is considered on duty at all times as a matter of public image and because tolerating such conduct might lead to similar infractions while the officer is formally at work. When complaints came in about the shift parties, the officers moved the drink fests from the city to the county, effectively removing them from departmental scrutiny. The honky-tonk where Dixie worked became their favorite haunt. At the time I met Dixie, she must have been in her mid-20s, older than me by 4 or 5 years. Mickey and I had been married for 6 weeks. I was still a rookie, working traffic while he'd been promoted to detective, assigned first to vice and then to burglary and theft under Lieutenant Dolan, who later moved on to homicide. Dixie was the one who organized the celebration for any transfer or promotion, and we all understood it was just one more excuse to party. I remembered sitting at that bar chatting with her while Mickey sucked back draft beers, playing pool with his cronies or trading war stories with the veterans coming back from Vietnam. At 18, he'd served a 14-month combat tour in Korea, and he was always interested in the contrast between the Korean War and what was taking place in Vietnam. Dixie's husband, Eric Hightower, had been wounded in Vietnam, returning to the States with both legs missing. In his absence, she'd put herself through bartending school, and she'd worked at the Tonks since the day Eric shipped out. After he came home, he'd sit there in his wheelchair, his behavior moody or manic, depending on his medications and his alcohol levels. Dixie kept him sedated on a steady regimen of Bloody Marys, which seemed to pacify his rage. To me, she seemed like a busy mother forced to bring her kid to work with her. The rest of us were polite, but Eric certainly didn't do much to endear himself. At 26, he was an old man and bitter about life. I used to watch in fascination while she assembled Mai Tais, gin and tonics, Manhattans, martinis, and revolting concoctions like pink squirrels and creme de menthe frappes. She talked incessantly, hardly looking at what she did, eyeballing the pour, spritzing soda or water from the bar hose. Sometimes she constructed four or five drinks at the same time without missing a beat. Her laugh was husky and low-pitched. She exchanged endless ribald comments with the guys, all of whom she knew by name and circumstance. I was impressed with her bawdy self-assurance. I also pitied her husband, with his sour disposition and his obvious limitations, which I assumed extended into sex. Even so, it never occurred to me that she would screw around on him, especially with my husband. I must have been brain dead not to notice, unless, of course, she was inventing this stuff to provide Mickey with the alibi that I'd declined to supply. Dixie was my height, rail thin, with a long, narrow face and an untidy tangle of auburn hair halfway down her back. Her brows were plucked, a wispy pair of arches that fanned out like wings from the bridge of her nose. Her eyes were darkly charcoaled, and she wore a fringe of fake lashes that made her eyes jump from her face. She was usually braless under her t-shirt, and she wore miniskirts so short she could hardly sit down. Sometimes she veered off in the opposite direction, donning long granny dresses or India print tunics over wide leg pantlets. I read her note again, but sure enough, the content was the same. She and Mickey had been having an affair. That seemed to be the subtext of her communication, though I found it hard to believe. He'd never given any indication he was even interested in her. Or maybe he had, and I'd been too dumb to pick up on it. How could she have stood there and chatted with me if the two of them were making it behind my back? On the other hand, the idea was not entirely inconsistent with Mickey's history. Before we'd connected, he'd been involved in numerous affairs. But he was, after all, single and savvy enough to avoid emotional entanglements. In the late 60s, early 70s, sex was casual, recreational, indiscriminate, and uncommitted. Women had been liberated by the advent of the birth control pill, and dope had erased any further prohibitions. This was the era of love-ins, psychedelics, dropouts, war protesters, body paint, assassinations, LSD, and rumors of kids so stoned their eyeballs got fried because they stared at the sun too long. It was also the era in which law enforcement began to change. In 1964, the Supreme Court had ruled, in the matter of Escobedo versus Illinois, that the refusal by the police to honor Escobedo's request to consult his lawyer during the course of an interrogation constituted a violation of the Sixth Amendment. 2 years later, 1966, in Miranda versus Arizona, the Supreme Court came down again on the side of the plaintiff, citing a breach of Sixth Amendment rights. From that point on, the climate in law enforcement underwent a shift, and the image of Dirty Harry was replaced by at least the appearance of restraint. Mickey chafed at the limitations set by policy, and on a broader level, at legal restrictions he felt interfered with his effectiveness. He was an old-fashioned cop. He identified with a crime victim. In his mind, theirs were the only claims that counted. Let the perpetrator fend for himself. He hated having to protect the guilty, and he had no patience for the so-called rights of those arrested. I sometimes suspected he'd formed his attitudes from the reams of pulp fiction he'd read growing up. Please understand that none of this was evident to me when we first met. I was not only infatuated with his attitude, but wide-eyed with admiration at what I mistook for his worldliness. I suspect in Mickey's view, certain rules and regulations simply didn't apply to him. He operated outside the standards most other cops finally came to accept. Mickey was accustomed to getting his way, experienced in what he called certain time-honored methods for persuading a suspect to make himself agreeable in the matter of inculpatory statements. Mickey usually said this in a tone that made everybody laugh. Mickey was revered by his fellow officers, and until that March, his departmental run-ins were focused on a series of minor infractions. He was late with his reports and occasionally insubordinate, though he seemed to have an instinct for how far he could push. He'd been the subject of two citizens' complaints, once for offensive language and once for excessive use of force. In both incidents, the department investigated and found in his favor. Still, it didn't look good. His was an odd mix of the offbeat and the conventional. In his personal life, he was scrupulously honest about his taxes, his bills, about his personal debts. He was loyal to his friends and discreet with regard to others. He also honored his commitments, except, apparently, to me. He would never violate a confidence, never rat out a pal or a fellow officer. Among men, he was much admired. With women, he was regarded with an admiration bordering on hero worship. I know because I did this myself, elevating his nonconformity to something praiseworthy instead of faintly dangerous. Looking back on it, I can see that I didn't want to know the truth about him. I had graduated from Police Academy in April of 1971 and was hired by the Santa Teresa Police Department as soon as I turned 21 in May. I'd met Mickey the previous November, and I was dazzled by the image he projected. Seasoned, gruff, cynical, wise. Within months, we fell in love, and by August, we were married. All of this before either of us understood what the other was about. Once committed, I was determined to see him as the man I wanted him to be. I needed to believe. I saw him as an idol, so I accepted his version of events even when common sense suggested he was slanting the facts. In the fall of 1971, after Mickey was reassigned to burglary and theft, he developed what was euphemistically referred to as a personality conflict with Con Dolan, who headed crimes against property. Lieutenant Dolan was an autocrat and a stickler for regulations, which caused the two of them to clash time and time again. Their differences put an end to Mickey's hopes for advancement. 6 months later, in the spring of 1972, Mickey resigned from the department to avoid yet another tangle with internal affairs. He was, at the time, under investigation for voluntary manslaughter after he'd been involved in a bar dispute. His altercation with a transient named Benny Quintero resulted in the man's death. This was March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, and Mickey was off duty drinking at the honky-tonk with a bunch of buddies who supported his account. He claimed the man was drunk and abusive and exhibited threatening behavior. Mickey removed him bodily to the parking lot where the two engaged in a brief shoving match. To hear Mickey tell it, he'd pushed the guy around some, but only in response to the drunk's attack. Witnesses swore he hadn't landed any blows. Benny Quintero left the scene, and that was the last anyone reported seeing him until his body was discovered the next day, beaten and bloody, dumped by the side of Highway 154. IA launched an investigation, and Mickey's attorney, Mark Bethel, advised him to keep his mouth shut. Since Mickey was the prime suspect, facing the possibility of criminal charges, Bethel was doing what he could to cover his backside. IA can coerce testimony, but is forbidden to share findings with the DA's office. There could be serious consequences all the same. Given the overarching need for honest officers, the department was determined to pursue the matter. Mickey resigned in order to avoid questioning. If he hadn't left when he did, he'd have been fired anyway for his refusal to respond. The day Mickey turned in his badge, his weapon, and his radio, his fellow officers were incensed. Department regulations prohibited his superiors from making any public statement, and Mickey downplayed his departure, which made him look all the more heroic in the eyes of his comrades. The impression he gave was that, despite their treatment of him, his loyalty to the department overrode his right to defend himself against accusations completely contrived and unfair. So convincing was he that I believed him myself right up to the moment when he asked me to lie for him. A criminal investigation was initiated, which is where I came in. Apparently, there were 4 hours unaccounted for in Mickey's alibi for that night. He refused to say where he'd been or what he'd done between the time he'd left the honky-tonk and the time he'd arrived home. He was suspected of following the guy and finishing the job elsewhere, but Mickey denied the whole thing. He asked me to cover for him, and that's when I walked. I left him April 1st and filed for divorce on the 10th of that month. Some weeks later, the findings from the coroner's exam revealed that Quintero, a Vietnam veteran, had suffered a service-related head injury. In combat, he'd been hit by sniper fire, and a stainless steel plate now served where a portion of his skull had been blown away. The official cause of death was a slow hemorrhage in the depths of his brain. Any minor blow could have generated the fatal seepage. In addition, the toxicology report showed a blood alcohol of 0.15 with traces of amphetamine, marijuana, and cocaine. There was no actual evidence that Mickey had encountered Benny after their initial scuffle in the parking lot. The DA declined to file charges, so Mickey was off the hook. By then, of course, the damage had been done. He'd been separated from the city, and he was soon afterward permanently separated from me. In the intervening years, my disenchantment had begun to fade. While I didn't want to see him, I didn't wish him ill. The last I'd heard, he was doing personal security. A once dedicated cop, demoted to working night shift in an imitation cop's uniform. I read the letter again, wondering what I would have done if I'd received it back then. I felt a ripple of anxiety coursing through my frame. If this were true, then I had indeed contributed to his ruin. I opened the drawer and took out my address book, which opened as if by magic to the page where he was listed. I picked up the handset and punched in the number. The line rang twice, and then I was greeted with a big two-tone whistling and the usual canned message telling me the number in the 213 area code was no longer in service. If I felt I'd reached the recording in error, I could recheck the number and then dial it again. Just to be certain, I redialed the number and heard the same message. I hung up trying to decide if there were any other possibility I should pursue. I hadn't visited the house on Chapel Street for a good 15 years. I parked out in front and let myself into the yard through a small wrought iron gate. The house was white frame, a homely story and a half with an angular bay window and a narrow side porch. Two second-story windows seemed to perch on the bay, and a simple wood filigree embellished the peaked roof. Built in 1875, the house was plain, lacking sufficient charm and period detail to warrant protection by the local historical preservationists. Out front, a stream of one-way traffic was a constant reminder of downtown Santa Teresa, only two blocks away. In another few years, the property would probably be sold, and the house would finish its days as a second-hand furniture store or a little mom-and-pop business. Eventually, the building would be razed, and the lot would be offered up as prime commercial real estate. I suppose not every vintage single-family dwelling can be spared the wrecker's ball. But a day will soon come when the history of the common folk will be entirely erased. The mansions of the wealthy will remain where they stand, the more ponderous among them converted for use by museums, art academies, and charitable foundations. A middle-class home like this would scarcely survive to the turn of another century. For the moment, it was safe. The front yard was well-tended, and the exterior paint looked fresh. I knew from past occasions the backyard was spacious, complete with a hand-laid brick patio, a built-in barbecue pit, and an orchard of fruit trees. I pressed the front doorbell. A shrill note echoed harshly through the house. Peter Shackelford, Shack, and his wife Bundy had been close friends of Mickey's long before we met. Theirs was a second marriage for both. Shack was divorced, Bundy widowed. Shack had adopted Bundy's four kids and raised them as his own. In those days, the couple entertained often and easily. Pizza, potluck suppers, and backyard barbecues. Paper plates, plasticware, and bring-your-own-bottle. With everyone pitching in on cleanup. There were usually babies in diapers, toddlers taking off on cross-lawn forays. The older kids played frisbee or raced around the yard like a bunch of hooligans. With all the parents on the scene, discipline was casual and democratic. Anyone close to the miscreant was authorized to act. In those days, I wasn't quite so self-congratulatory about my childless state, and I would occasionally keep an eye on the little ones while their parents cut loose. Mickey and Shaq had joined the Santa Teresa Police Department at just about the same time and had worked in close proximity. They were never partners, per se, but the two of them, along with a third cop named Roy Litt Littenberg, were known as the Three Musketeers. Litt and Shaq were part of the crowd at the honky-tonk the year Mickey went down. I was hoping one or the other would know his whereabouts and his current status. I also needed confirmation of the letter's contents. I'd been convinced Mickey was guilty of the beating that resulted in Benny's death. I wasn't sure what I'd do if it turned out he'd had a legitimate alibi for that night. The idea made my stomach roil with anxiety. Shaq answered the door half a minute later, though it took him another 10 seconds to figure out who I was. The delay gave me a chance to register the changes in him. In the period when I'd known him, he must have been in his late 30s. He was now in his early 50s and a good 25 pounds heavier. Gravity had tugged at all the planes in his face, now defined by a series of downward-turning lines, dense brows over drooping eyelids, sagging cheeks, a bushy mustache, and heavy mouth curving down toward his double chin. His thick salt-and-pepper hair was clipped close to his head, as though he was still subject to departmental regulations. He was wearing shorts, flip-flops, and a loose white T-shirt, the sagging neckline revealing a froth of white chest hair. Like Mickey, Shaq had lifted weights 3 days a week, and there was still the suggestion of power in the way he carried himself. "Hello, Shaq. How are you?" I said when I could see that my identity had been noted. I didn't bother to smile. This was not a social visit, and I guessed his feelings for me were neither friendly nor warm. His tone when he spoke was surprisingly mild. "I always figured you'd show up." "Here I am," I said. "Mind if I come in?"
"Why not?"
He stepped aside, allowing me to enter the front hall ahead of him. Given the echoes of the past, the quiet seemed unnatural.
"Might as well follow me out back. I don't spend a lot of time in this part of the house."
Shaq closed the door and moved down the hall toward the kitchen. Even the most cursory glance showed half the furniture was gone. In the living room, I spotted a coffee table, miscellaneous side tables, and a straight-back wooden chair. The silver dollar-sized circles of matted carpeting indicated where the couch and easy chairs had once been. The built-in bookcases flanking the fireplace were now bereft of books. In their place, 25 to 30 framed photographs showed a myriad of smiling faces, babies, children, and adults. Most were studio portraits, but there were several enlargements of snapshots from family gatherings. "Are you moving?" He shook his head.
"Bundy died 6 months ago," he said. "Most of the furniture was hers anyway. I let the kids take most of it. There's plenty left for my purposes."
"Is that them in the photographs?"
"Them and their kids. We got 13 grandchildren among the four of them."
"Congratulations."
"Thanks. The youngest, Jessie, you remember her?"
"Dark curly hair?"
"That's her. The wild one in the bunch. She hasn't married to date, but she adopted 2 Vietnamese children."
"What's she doing for a living?"
"Attorney in New York. She does corporate law."
"Do any of the others live close?"
"Scott's down in Sherman Oaks. They're spread out all over, but they visit when they can. Every 6-8 months, I fire up the Harley and do a big round trip. Good kids, all of them. Bun did a hell of a job. I'm a sorry substitute, but I do what I can."
"What are you up to these days? I heard you left the department."
"A year ago this May. I don't do much of anything, to tell you the truth."
"You still lifting weights?"
"Can't. I got hurt. Had an accident on duty. Some drunk ran a red light and broadsided my patrol car. Killed him outright and knocked me all to hell and gone. I got a fractured 5th vertebrae, so I ended up taking an industrial retirement. A workers' comp claim."
"Too bad."
"No point complaining about things you can't change. The money pays the bills and gives me time to myself. What about you? I hear you're a PI.
I've been doing that for years."
He led me through the kitchen to the glassed-in porch that ran along the rear of the house. He seemed to live the way I did, confined to one area like a pet left alone while its owners are off at work. The kitchen was completely tidy. I could see a single plate, a cereal bowl, a spoon, and a coffee mug in the dish rack. He probably used the same few utensils carefully washing up between meals. Why put anything away when you're only going to take it out and use it again? There was something homely about the presence of the dishes in the rack. From the look of it, he lived almost exclusively in the kitchen and enclosed porch. A futon, doubling as a couch, was set up at one end, blankets neatly folded with the pillows stacked on top. There was a TV on the floor. The rest of the porch was taken up with woodworking equipment, a lathe, a drill press, a router, a couple of C-clamps, a vise, wood chisel, a table saw, and an assortment of planes. He was in the process of refinishing two pieces. The chest of drawers had been stripped, pending further attention. A wooden kitchen chair had been laid on its back, its legs sticking out as stiffly as a dead possum's. Shaq must sleep every night with the heady scent of turpentine, glue, tongue oil, and wood shavings. He caught my look and said, "Virtue of being single. You can do anything you want." I said, "I'm into that." Once upon a time, Bundy had sewn the cafe curtains, hanging them on rods across the middle of the row of windows. The green and white checked cotton, probably permanent press, still looked fresh, crisp, carefully laundered with little clip-on curtain rings. I found my eyes filling inexplicably with tears and had to feign attention to the backyard, which I could see through the glass. Many of the trees remained, as bent as old spines, curving toward the ground from a once proud height. A saddle of purple morning glories was cinched to the fence, the chicken wire now sway-backed from the weight of the vines. The barbecue grill top had turned red-brown with rust, replaced by a portable kettle grill parked closer to the back steps. Shaq leaned against the wall with his arms folded across his chest.
"So, what's the reason for the call?"
"I'm looking for Mickey. The only number I have is a disconnect."
"You have business with him?"
"I may. I'm not sure. Do I need your approval before I telephone the man?"
Shaq seemed amused.
Bundy had always given him a hard time. Maybe he missed the rough and tumble of conversation. Live alone long enough and you forget what it's like. His smile faded slightly.
"No offense, kiddo, but why not leave him alone?"
"I want to know he's okay. I don't intend to bother him. When's the last time you spoke?"
"I don't remember."
"I see. Do you have any idea what's going on with him?"
"I'm sure he's fine. Mickey's a big boy. He doesn't need anyone hovering."
"Fair enough," I said. "But I'd like the reassurance. That's all this is. Do you have his current phone or address?"
Shaq shook his head and his mouth pulled down. "Nope. He initiates contact when it suits. In between calls, I make a point of leaving him alone. That's the deal we made."
"What about Lit?"
"Roy Littenberg died. The Big C took him out in less than 6 weeks. This was, 3 years ago."
"I'm sorry to hear that. I liked him."
"Me too. I see his boy now and then, Tim. You'll never guess what he does."
"I give up."
"He bought the honky-tonk. Him and Bundy's boy, Scotty, pal around together whenever Scotty's in town."
I said, "Really? I don't remember meeting either one. I think both were off in Vietnam when Mickey and I were hanging out here."
In Santa Teresa, all paths were destined to cross and recross eventually. Now the next generation was being folded into the mix.
"Can you think of anyone else who might know what Mickey's up to?"
Shaq studied me. "What's my motive in this?"
"You could be helping him."
"And what's yours?"
"I want the answer to some questions I should have asked back then."
"About Benny?"
"That's right." His smile was shrewd. He cupped a hand to his ear.
"Do I hear guilt?"
"If you like."
"A little late, don't you think?"
"Probably. I'm not sure. The point is, I don't need your permission. Now, will you help me or not?"
He thought about it briefly. "What about the lawyer who represented him?"
"Bethel? I can try. I should have thought of him. That's a good idea."
"I'm full of good ideas." You think Mickey was innocent?
Of course. I was there and I saw. The guy was fine when he left.
Shaq, he had a plate in his head.
Mickey didn't hit him. He never landed a blow.
How do you know he didn't go after him again? The two might have gotten into it somewhere else. Mickey wasn't exactly famous for his self-control. That was one of my complaints.
Shaq wagged his head. The gesture turned into a neck roll, complete with cracking sound. Sorry about that. I'm going to see the chiropractor later on, account of this effing neck of mine. Yeah, it's possible. Why not? Maybe there was more to it than Mickey let on. I'm telling you what I saw, and it was no big deal.
Fair enough.
Incidentally, not that it's any of my business, but you should have stood by him. That's the least you could do. This isn't just me. A lot of the guys resented what you did.
Well, I resented Mickey's asking me to lie for him. He wanted me to tell the DA he was in at 9 o'clock that night, instead of midnight or 1 o'clock, whatever the hell time it was when he finally rolled in.
Oh, that's right, he said snidely. You never tell lies yourself.
Not about murder, absolutely not, I snapped.
Bullshit. You really think Magruder beat a guy to death?
How do I know? That's what I'm trying to find out. Mickey was off course. He was intent on the might and the right of the law, and he didn't give a damn what he had to do to get the job done.
Yeah, and you ask my opinion, there should have been more like him. Besides, what I hear, you're not exactly one to be casting stones.
I'll grant you that one. That's why I'm not in uniform today. But my butt wasn't on the line back then, his was. If Mickey had an alibi, he should have said so up front instead of asking me to lie.
Shaq's expression shifted and he broke off eye contact. I said,
come on, Shaq. You know perfectly well where he was. Why don't you fill me in and we can put an end to this?
Is that why you're here?
In the main, I said.
I can tell you this much, he wasn't on Highway 154 hassling a vet. He wasn't anywhere within miles.
That's good. I believe you. Now, could we try this? Mickey had a girlfriend. You remember Dixie Hightower? According to her, they were together that night, getting it on, to use the time-honored phrase.
So he was sticking it to Dixie. Whoopee-doo. So what? Everybody screwed around in those days.
I didn't.
Maybe not when you were married, but you were the same as everyone else, only maybe not as open or as honest.
I bypassed the judgment and went back to the subject under discussion. Someone could have warned me.
We assumed you knew. Neither of them went to any great lengths to cover up. Think of all the times you left the honky-tonk before him. What'd you think he was doing, going to night school? He was nailing her. Big deal. She was a bimbo-tended bar. She wasn't any threat to you.
I swallowed my outrage, dismissing it as unproductive. I needed information, not an argument. Betrayal is betrayal, no matter when the truth of it sinks in. Whether Dixie was a threat to that marriage was beside the point. Even 15 years later, I felt humiliated and incensed. I closed my eyes, detaching myself emotionally as though at the scene of a homicide. Do you know for a fact he was with her that night?
Let's put it this way. I saw him leave the Tonk together. She was in her car. He was behind her in his. Nights her hubby was home. They checked into that dinky little motel out on Airport Road.
Wonderful. That's nice. How considerate of them. They were there that night?
Probably. I couldn't say for sure, but I'd be willing to bet.
Why didn't you speak up for him?
I would have, for sure. I'd have gone to the wall, but I never had the chance. Mickey turned in his badge, and that was the end of that. If you can't reach him, you can always ask her.
Dixie?
Sure, she's around.
Where?
You're the detective. Try the telephone book. She's still married to Woozy Face, cripple guy.
His name was Eric.
That's right. Him and Dixie made a fortune and bought a mansion. 16,000 square feet, something like that. Big.
You're kidding.
I'm not. It's the honest-to-God truth. They're living in Montebello on a regular estate.
How'd he do that? The last I saw, he was a hopeless drunk.
He got into AA and straightened up his act. Once he sobered up, he figured out a way to build designer wheelchairs. Custom jobs with all the bells and whistles, depending on the disability. Now he's added sports chairs and prostheses. He has a plant in Taiwan making parts for other companies, too. Donates a ton of stuff to children's hospitals across the country.
Good for him. I'm glad to hear that. What about her? What's she doing with herself?
She's living the life of Riley, turned into Mrs. Got Rocks. Country club membership and everything. You look him up, tell him I said hi.
Maybe I'll do that. After I left Shaq's, I went into the office, where I opened the mail. There was nothing of interest and no pressing business. Most of my other cases were in limbo, pending callbacks or responses to written inquiries of various sorts. I tidied my desk and washed the coffee pot. I dusted the leaves on the fake ficus. I had no reason to stay, but I couldn't go home yet. I was restless, brooding about Mickey in a series of thought loops that went around and around. Had I erred? Had I acted in haste, jumping to conclusions because it suited me? By the time Quintero died, I was disenchanted with Mickey anyway. I wanted out of the marriage, so his involvement in Quintero's death provided the perfect excuse. But maybe that's all it was. Could he have resigned from the department to spare my pride and at the same time to avoid exposing Dixie? If Mickey were innocent, if I'd known where he was that night, the case might have gone differently and he might still be a cop. I didn't want to believe it, but I couldn't escape the thought. I lay down on the carpet and flung an arm across my eyes. Was there really any point in obsessing about this? It was over and done with. 15 years had gone by. Whatever the truth, Mickey'd elected to resign. That was a fact. I'd left him and our lives were irreparably changed. Why pursue the matter when there wasn't any way to alter what had happened? What was at stake was my integrity, whatever sense of honor I possessed. I know my limitations, I know the occasional lapses I'm capable of, but a transgression of this magnitude was impossible to ignore. Mickey had lost what he'd loved best, and maybe that was simply his inevitable fate. Then again, if I'd been an unwitting accomplice to his downfall, I needed to own up to it and get square with him. Forbes Run was a meandering lane and a half, a ribbon of pavement that snaked back and forth as it angled upward into the foothills. Massive branches of live oak hung out over the road. There were no houses visible as far as I could see, but a series of markers suggested that large properties branched off at intervals. I watched the numbers progress, the signs leapfrogging from one side of the road to the other, alternating even and odd, 317, 320, 323, 326. The Hightower's estate at 329 was surrounded by a low fieldstone wall, accessible through wooden gates that opened electronically as soon as I pressed the button. Either the Hightowers were expecting someone, or they didn't much care who appeared at their door. The driveway extended perhaps a quarter of a mile and conjured up visions of a proper English manor house at the far end, a three-story Tudor with a steeply pitched slate roof. What I spotted, at long last, was nothing of the kind. The house was contemporary, long and low, hugging the ground, with an oversized roofline rising to a center peak. I could see four wide fieldstone chimneys, clusters of fan palms, and colossal black boulders the size of my car that must have erupted from Vesuvius and had been transported to the grounds for effect. To the right, I could see a line of four garages. I parked in the large circular parking area in front and made my way up the wide, sloping concrete walk. A woman, perhaps 30, in tennis shoes, jeans, and a white T-shirt, was already standing in the open doorway awaiting my arrival. This definitely wasn't Dixie, and I was wondering for a fleeting moment if I'd come to the wrong house. "Ms. Yablonsky," she said. "Actually, I'm not. I'm looking for Eric and Dixie Hightower. Am I in the right place?" "Sorry, of course. I thought you were someone else. We've been interviewing for staff positions, and the woman's half an hour late. Is Mrs. Hightower expecting you?" The woman herself remained nameless and without title. Parlor maid, factotum, personal assistant. I guess she felt she was under no obligation to introduce herself. "I'm an old friend," I said. I took out a business card and handed it to her. She read the face of it, frowning. "A private detective? What's this about?" "I'm hoping they can put me in touch with a mutual acquaintance. A guy named Mickey Magruder, my ex-husband." "Oh, why don't you come in and I'll tell Mrs. Hightower you're here." "Is Eric home?" "Mr. Hightower's out of town. He should be home soon." I stepped into the foyer, waiting uneasily while she disappeared from sight. I'm sometimes puzzled by wealth, which seems to have a set of rules of its own. Was I free to amble about, or should I wait where I was? There was an angular stone bench positioned against one wall. The woman hadn't suggested I sit, and I was loath to presume. Suppose it turned out to be a sculpture that collapsed under my weight. I did a 180 turn so I could scrutinize the place like a burglar in training, a little game I play. I noted entrances and exits, wondering about the possibility of a wall safe. If I were bugging the place, where would I tuck the surveillance equipment? The floors were polished marble, as pale as beach sand. I could see ancient marine creatures pressed into the surface, a tiny fossil museum at my feet. A wide corridor stretched off to the right. The ceiling was 12 feet high, with floor-to-ceiling windows on one side. The facing walls were painted a snowy white and hung with a series of bright abstracts, oil paintings 6 feet tall, probably expensive and done by someone dead. Before me, a pair of double doors stood open, and I could see into the living room, easily 30 feet long. Again, the walls on the far side were floor-to-ceiling glass, this time with a panoramic view of pines, live oaks, giant ferns, eucalyptus, and the mountains beyond. I listened and, hearing nothing, tiptoed into the room to have a better look. The wood-beam ceiling slanted upward to near cathedral heights. On the left, there was a marble-faced fireplace with a hearth 26 feet long. On the other end of the room, glass-enclosed shelves showcased a variety of art objects. To the left, I could see a built-in wet bar. The furniture was simple: large, armless black leather couches and chairs, chrome and glass tables, a grand piano, recessed lighting. I heard footsteps tap, tap, tapping down the marble hallway in my direction. I just managed to giant step my way across the foyer to my original position when Dixie came into view. She wore skin-tight blue jeans, boots with a spike heel, and a buff-colored blazer over a snowy white silk tank top. Her jewelry was bakelite, two chunky bracelets that clattered on her narrow wrist. Now 40 years old, she was still extremely thin. Small hips, flat stomach, scarcely any butt to speak of. The shoulder pads in her jacket made it look like she was wearing protective gear. Her hair was pulled back away from her face, an oh-so-chic mess in a shade that suggested copious chemical assistance. A red somewhere between claret and burnt ochre. Gone were the false eyelashes and all the heavy black eyeliner. Curiously, the absence of makeup made her eyes seem much larger and her features more delicate. Her skin was sallow, and there were dark circles under her eyes, lines in her forehead, cords showing in her neck. Hard to believe she hadn't yet availed herself of a little surgical refreshment. Even so, she looked glamorous. There was something brisk and brittle in the way she carried herself. She seemed to know who I was, using my name with an artificial warmth as she held out her hand.
"Kinsey, how nice. What an incredible surprise. Steffi said you were here."
"It's been years." "Hello, Dixie. You look great. I wasn't sure you'd remember me."
"How could I forget?" she said. "I'm sorry you missed Eric."
Her gaze took me in without so much as a flicker of interest. Like her, I wore jeans, though mine were cut without style, the kind worn to wash cars or clean hair clots from the bathroom standpipe. In the years since I'd seen her, she'd risen in social stature, acquiring an almost indescribable air of elegance. No need to wear diamonds when plastic would do. Her jacket was wrinkled in the manner of expensive fabrics, linens, and silks. You know how it is with that shit. She glanced at her watch, which she wore on the inner aspect of her wrist. The watch was 40s vintage. Stingy-sized crystal surrounded by little bitty diamonds on a band of black cording. I'd seen nicer versions at the swap meet, which just goes to show what I know about these things. Hers was probably rare, recognizable on sight by those who shopped in the Tony places she did.
"Would you like a drink?" she asked. "It's nearly cocktail time."
My watch said 4:10. I said, "Sure, why not?" I almost made a joke about creme de menthe frappes, but a black guy in a white jacket had materialized, a silver tray in hand. A bartender of her own. This was getting good. She said,
"What would you like?"
"Chardonnay sounds fine."
"We'll be out on the patio," she remarked without directly addressing her faithful attendant.
My, my, my. Another cipher accounted for in the nameless servant class. I noticed Dixie didn't need to specify what she'd be drinking this afternoon. I followed her through the marble-floored dining room. The table was a rhomboid of cherry with sufficient chairs assembled for a party of 12. Something odd was at work, and it took me a moment to figure out what it was. There were no steps, no changes in elevation, no area rugs, and no signs of wall-to-wall carpet within view. I thought of Eric in his wheelchair, wondering if the floors were left bare for his benefit. It struck me as peculiar that Dixie hadn't yet questioned the reason for my unannounced arrival at her door. Maybe she'd been waiting for me all these years, rehearsing responses to numerous imaginary conversations. She'd always known she'd been screwing around with Mickey, whereas I'd just found out, which put me at a disadvantage. I don't often go up against other women in verbal combat. Such clashes are strange, but not without a certain prurient attraction. I thought of all the male fantasy movies where women fought like alley cats, pulling at each other's hair while they rolled around on the floor. I'd never had much occasion, but maybe that would change. I could feel myself getting in touch with my inner mean streak. Dixie opened a sliding glass door, and we passed out onto the spacious, screened-in patio. The floor here was smooth stone, and the area was rimmed with a series of 20-foot trees in enormous terracotta pots. The branches were filled with goldfinches, all twittering as they hopped from limb to limb. There was a grouping of upholstered patio furniture nearby, in addition to a glass-topped table and four thickly cushioned chairs. Everything looked spotless, and I wondered where the little birdies dropped their tiny green and white turds.
"This is actually a combination greenhouse and aviary. These are specimen plants, proteus and bromeliads, South American," she said.
I murmured, "Gorgeous," for lack of anything better. I thought a bromeliad was a remedy for acid indigestion. She gestured toward the conversational grouping of chairs. From somewhere, I could already smell dinner in the making. The scent of sautéed garlic and onion like a sumptuous perfume floated in the air. Maybe one of these no-name indentured servants would appear with a tray of eats, little tidbits of something I could fall on and snarf down without using my hands. As soon as we sat down, the man reappeared with the drinks on his tray. He gave us each a tiny cloth napkin in case we irped something up. Dixie's beverage of choice was a martini, straight up in a 40s-style glass. Four green olives were lined up on a toothpick like beads on an abacus. We each took a sip of our respective libations. My Chardonnay was delicate, with a long, slow, vanilla finish. Probably nothing from a screw-top bottle at the neighborhood Stop and Shop. I watched her hold the gin on her tongue like a communion ritual. She set the glass down with a faint tap and reached into her blazer pocket to extract a pack of cigarettes and a small gold lighter. She lit the cigarette, inhaling with a reverence that suggested smoking was another sacrament. When she caught me observing her, she opened her mouth to emit a thick tongue of smoke that she then sucked up her nose.
"You don't smoke these days?"
I shook my head. "I quit."
"Good for you. I'll never give it up myself. All this talk about health is fairly tedious. You probably exercise, too.
She cocked her head in reflection, striking a bemused pose.
Let's see, what's in fashion at the moment? You lift weights?
She said and pointed a finger in my direction. I jog 5 days a week, too, don't forget that, I said and pointed back at her. She took another sip of her drink.
Steffi tells me you're looking for Mickey.
Has he disappeared? Not as far as I know, but I'd like to get in touch with him. The only number I have turns out to be a disconnect. Have you heard from him lately?
Not for years, she said.
A smile formed on her lips, and she checked her fingernails.
That's a curious question. I can't believe you'd ask me. I'm sure there are other folks much more likely to know.
Such as?
Shaq, for one. And who's the other cop? Lit something? They were always thick as thieves.
I just talked to Shaq, which is how I got to you. Roy Littenberg died. I didn't realize you and Eric were still in town. She studied me for a moment through her cigarette smoke. Miss Dixie wasn't dumb, and I could see her analyze the situation.
Where's all this coming from?
All what?
You have something else in mind, or am I wrong about that?
I reached down from my shoulder bag and removed the letter from the outside pocket. Got your letter, I said.
My letter?
She repeated blankly, her gaze fixed on the envelope. The one you sent me in 1972, I said. Mickey tossed it in a box with some other mail that must have come in the same day. He failed to deliver it, so I never read the letter until today. For once, I seemed to have captured her full attention.
You're not serious.
I am. I held up the letter like a paddle in a silent auction. My bid. I had no idea you were bawling my beloved husband.
You want to talk about that?
She laughed and then caught herself. Her teeth were now as perfect as white horseshoes hinged together at the rear of her mouth.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I hope you won't take offense. But you're such a boob when it comes to men.
Thanks. You know how I value your opinion.
Nothing to be ashamed of. Most women don't have the first clue about men.
And you do.
Of course.
Dixie studied me over the ribbon of cigarette smoke, taking my measure with her eyes. She paused and leaned forward to tap off a cylinder of ash into a cut glass dish on the coffee table in front of her. What's your theory, Miss Dixie, if I may be so bold as to inquire? I said, affecting a southern accent.
Take advantage of them before they take advantage of you, she said, her smile as thin as glass.
Nice. Romantic. I better write that down. I pretended to make a note on the palm of my hand.
Well, it's not nice, but it's practical. In case you haven't noticed, most men don't give a shit about romance.
They want to get in your panties and let it go with that. What else can I say? That about covers it, I said. May I ask why him? There were dozens of cops at the honky-tonk back then. She hesitated, apparently considering what posture to affect.
He was very good, she said with a trace of a smile.
I didn't ask for an evaluation. I'd like to know what went on.
Why, the attitude. You seem so belligerent. In the end, you'd have left him anyway, so what do you care?
Indulge me, I said, for the sake of argument. She lifted one thin shoulder in a delicate shrug.
He and I were an item long before the two of you met. He broke it off for a while, and then he came back. Why attach anything to it? We were not in love by any stretch. I might have admired him, but I can't say I liked him much. He had a rough kind of charm, but then again, you know that. I wouldn't even call it an affair in any true sense of the word. More like sexual addiction. A mutual service we performed. Or should I say, that's what it was for me. I don't know about him. It's a question of pathology. He probably couldn't help himself any more than I.
Oh, please. Don't give me that horse shit about sexual addiction. What crap, I said.
Did it ever occur to you that wedding vows mean something? Yours didn't seem to mean much. Until death do us part.
At least I'm still married, which is more than you can say.
Or am I wrong about that? Rude of me. You might have married someone else and had a whole passel of kids.
I would have asked before now, but I didn't see a ring. Were you with him the night Benny Quintero died? Her smile faded.
Yes.
Flat. No hesitation, no emotion, and no elaboration.
Why didn't he tell me? Did you really want to know?
It would have helped. I'm not sure what I'd have done, but it might have made a difference.
I doubt that. You were such a cocky little thing.
Really, quite obnoxious. You knew it all back then. Mickey wanted you spared.
And why is that? He was crazy about you. I'm surprised you'd have to ask.
Given the fact he was screwing you, I said.
You knew his history the day you married him. Did you seriously imagine he'd be monogamous?
Why'd you take it on yourself to tattle when Mickey asked you not to? I was afraid he'd get a raw deal, which he did, as it turns out. Did Eric know about Mickey? There was the tiniest flicker of hesitation.
We've come to an accommodation.
I'm not talking about now. Did he know back then? She took a long, deliberate drag on her cigarette while she formed her reply.
Life was difficult for Eric. He had a hard time adjusting after he got back.
In other words, no.
There was no emotional content between Mickey and me. Why inflict unnecessary pain?
How about so your respective spouses know the truth about you? As long as there's no love, as long as it's simply sexual servicing, as you claim, why couldn't you tell us? She was silent, giving me a wide-eyed stare. The question isn't hypothetical. I really want to know, I said. Why not be honest with us if your relationship meant so little? I waited. Okay, I'll help. You want the answer? Try this. Because we'd have kicked your respective butts and put an end to it. I don't know about Eric, but I have no tolerance for infidelity.
Perhaps there are things about loyalty you never grasped, she said.
I closed my eyes briefly. I wanted to lift her front chair legs and flip her backward, just for the satisfaction of hearing her head thud against the stone floor. Instead, I silently recited what I remembered of the penal code. An assault is an unlawful attempt, coupled with a present ability to commit a violent injury on the person of another. A battery is any willful and unlawful use of force or violence upon the person of another. I smiled. You think it was okay to make fools of us? To gratify your whims at our expense? If you think that's loyalty, you're really fucked.
You don't have to be crude.
Someone spoke from the far side of the patio.
Excuse me, Dixie.
Both of us looked over. Steffi stood in the doorway. For once, Dixie seemed embarrassed and the color rose in her cheeks.
Yes, Steffi, what is it?
Ms. Yablonsky's here. Did you want to talk to her now or should I reschedule? Dixie exhaled with impatience, stubbing out her cigarette.
Have her wait in my office. I'll be there in a minute.
Sure, no problem. Steffi closed the sliding glass door, watching for a moment before she moved away.
This has gone far enough, Dixie said to me. I can see you enjoy getting up on your high horse. You always like claiming the moral high ground.
I do.
That's correct.
It's mine to claim in this case.
When you've finished your drink, you can let yourself out.
Thanks. This was fun. You haven't changed at all.
Nor have you, she said.
I was halfway down the driveway, heading toward the road, when I saw a vehicle coming my way. It was a custom van of a sort I hadn't seen before, sleek, black, and boxy, with Eric Hightower at the wheel. I'm not sure I would have recognized him if I hadn't been half expecting to see him anyway. I slowed the VW to a crawl and gave a tap to the horn as I rolled down my window. He drew alongside me and pulled to a stop, rolling his window down in response. Underneath the tank top he wore, his bulging shoulders and biceps looked smooth and tanned. In the old honky-tonk days, his gaze was perpetually glassy, and his skin had the pallor of a man who'd made a science of mixing his medications with alcohol, LSD, and grass. Then his beard had been sparse, and he'd worn his straight black hair loose across his shoulders, or pulled back in a ponytail and tied with a rag. The man who studied me quizzically from the driver's side of the van had been restored to good health. His head was now shaved, his skull as neat as a newborn's. Gone was the beard and the bleary-eyed stare. I'd seen pictures of Eric in uniform before he left for Vietnam. Young and handsome, 21 years old, largely untouched by life. After two tours of duty, he'd come back to the world looking gaunt and abused, sour and withdrawn. He'd seemed to have a lot on his mind, but nothing he was capable of explaining to the rest of us, and none of us dared ask. One look at this face was sufficient to convince us that what he'd seen was hellish and wouldn't bear close scrutiny. In retrospect, I suspect he imagined us judgmental and disapproving, when in truth we were frightened of what we saw in his eyes. Better to look away than to suffer that torment.
"Can I help you?" he asked.
"Hi, Eric. Kinsey Milhone. We hung around together years ago at the Tonk out in Colgate." I watched his features clear and then brighten when he figured out who I was.
"Hey! Of course! No fooling! How are you doing these days?"
He leaned his left arm out the window and we touched fingertips briefly, as close to a handshake as we could manage from separate vehicles. His dark eyes were clear. In his drinking days, he'd been scrawny, but the process of aging had added the requisite 15 pounds. Success sat well on him. He seemed substantial and self-possessed. I said, "You look great. What happened to your hair?" He glanced at himself in his rearview mirror, running a hand across his smooth-shaven skull.
"You like it? It feels weird. I did that a month ago and can't quite decide."
"I do. It's better than the ponytail."
"Well, ain't that the truth. What brings you here?"
"I'm looking for my ex-husband and thought you might have a line on him." The possibility seemed far-fetched, and I wondered if he'd press me on the subject, but he let that pass.
"Magruder? I haven't seen him in years."
"That's what Dixie said. I talked to Mickey's buddy, Shaq, a little while ago, and your names came up. You remember Pete Shackelford?"
"Vaguely."
"He thought you might know, but I guess not, huh?" Eric said.
Sorry I can't help. What's the deal?"
"I'm not really sure. It looks like I have a debt to settle, and I'd like to clear it with him."
"I can ask around if you want. I still see some of those guys at the gym, and one of them might know."
"Thanks, but I can probably manage on my own. I'll call his lawyer, and if that fails, I've got some other little ways. I know how his mind works. Mickey's devious." Eric's gaze held mine, and I felt an unspoken communication scuttle between us, like the shadow of a cloud passing overhead. His mood seemed to shift, and he let the sweep of his arm encompass the tree-strewn property surrounding us on all sides.
"So, what do you think? 9.9 acres, and it's paid off. All mine. Well, half mine, given California's community property laws."
"It's beautiful. You've done well."
"Thanks. I had help."
"Dixie or AA?"
"I'd have to say both."
A plumber's truck appeared in the driveway, pulling up behind Eric's van. He glanced back and waved to let the driver know he was aware of him and wouldn't take all day. He turned back to me.
"Why don't you turn the car around and come back to the house? We can all have dinner together and spend time catching up."
"I'd love to, but I better not. Dixie's got interviews, and I have some things to take care of myself. Maybe another time. I'll give you a call, and we can set something up." I put my car in gear.
"Great. Do that. You promise?"
"Scout's honor." The driver of the truck behind him gave an impatient beep on his horn. Eric glanced back at him and waved again.
"Anyway, nice to see you. Behave yourself."
"You too." He rolled his window up and I could see him accelerate with the help of a device on his steering wheel. It was the only reminder I'd had that he was a double amputee. He tapped his horn as he departed and I continued down the driveway, the two of us moving in opposite directions. I headed into town, pondering the nature of the divine comedy. Two of my pet beliefs had been reversed in the past few hours. Given the brevity of my marriage to Mickey, I'd always assumed he'd been faithful. That notion turned out to be false, so it was stricken from the record, along with any lingering confidence I felt. I'd also suspected, well, let's be honest about this, I'd been convinced Mickey'd played a part in Benny Quintero's death. It turned out he hadn't, so we could strike that one, too. Guilty of infidelity, innocent of manslaughter. Someone with talent could convert that to lyrics for a country western tune. In some ways, Dixie'd nailed it. Did I really want to know about this shit? I guess I didn't have a choice.